I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 17. Join us as we step into the Collector's Corner once more with Sherlockian and mystery book dealer, Otto Penzler.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Baker Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Hi, and welcome back to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees, where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burt Wolder.
Here we are once again, poised on the brink of greatness, ready to bring you...
poised on the Reichenbach of opportunity.
I saw the Reichenbach, but I fell for you. I think we're looking forward here to continuing that conversation that we had with Jerry Margolin last time about his collection and parting with it. And today we're actually going to speak with the man who acquired the collection, Mr. Otto Penzler. Before we get into today's show, I just wanted to remind people that you can reach us in a variety of ways. We try to make it as easy as possible for you to participate in the conversation here. And it does mean a lot to us to hear from you and to understand whether we're hitting the mark or not, and to get ideas from you, and you name it. So you can call us at area code 774-221-7323. That's 774-221-READ. You can also send us an email. The email address is comment@ihearofsherlock.com. Or you can join us right on the website, www.ihearofsherlock.com. Leave a comment in one of the show episodes, or actually right within the Splashcast player if you'd like to leave a comment in the context of listening to the show right on the site there. In addition, I would encourage you to join our Facebook group. There's a link there on the website where you can join up. What we would like to do in the future in using the Facebook group is to just notify you of new episodes and new things going on, maybe do a few surveys, things like that. We also encourage you to vote for us over at Podcast Alley. Again, you'll find a link from the show site directly to Podcast Alley, where you can vote your approval for the show. And finally, we would ask that you perhaps during this time of year take some time out of your busy shopping schedule and perhaps consider a gift for I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. You know, this is a volunteer exercise that Bert and I undergo and undertake, and it's not free to us, even though it is free to you. So there are costs associated with equipment and hosting and keeping the site up and running and research and whatnot. So we would hope that you would take kindly in your heart this time of year and perhaps consider a gift to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere. And again, we make that possible online on the show website. Now, Otto is also a member of the Baker Street Irregulars and has been a writer, a publisher, and a bookseller, among other things in life. And we're going to kind of pick Otto's brain about what's going on in the world of mystery fiction and what Sherlockians and collectors can learn from him. And we'll also have an interesting opportunity for you to actually meet Otto should you be in New York in January. So, Otto, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So last time Bert and I were talking with Jerry Margolin, who is still with us right now, about his decision to give up his Sherlockian collection and to sell it to a dealer. And you, I guess, had the honor of being that dealer. Now, is this something that you specialize in typically? Tell us a little bit about your how that works from your perspective.
Well, I've been a specialty dealer specializing in mystery fiction and Sherlock Holmes for 29 years, and I've bought a lot of collections. It's the logical place for people to go when they're ready to dispose of a collection. It's not always the collector who decides that it's going to go. Many collectors make the effort to take it with them, and when they fail, their widows or widowers dispose of the books instead.
Well, that you must meet some, you know, if for someone who's collected, particularly for a very long period of time, it's such an emotional decision. Have you encountered people in emotional distress when they connect with you and begin to talk about parting with something they've been working on for a very long time?
Well, I think anybody who's been a serious collector, and heaven knows Jerry Margolin was a serious collector for a lot of years, I think when you make that decision, coming to the decision is what's really hard. I think once you've made the decision and the books then change hands, I think that's actually, in a strange way, easier than coming to that decision, although Jerry could speak to that himself. I've been collecting for even longer than Jerry, and I haven't disposed of my collection yet, and I can't imagine doing it yet. I'm just not ready. I don't know if I'll ever be ready.
What's your specialty? What's your area of collection?
I collect mystery fiction. I have 60,000 first editions.
Come again?
60,000.
60,000. Wow. Where do you keep it?
Well, I had to build a house to hold it. I mean, well, basically I had to build a library and then attach a little thing that, you know, we live in and have a kitchen and bathroom and bedroom, yeah.
Yeah, we sleep under the desk.
Although, if I can interject, Otto, you did sell your Sherlockian collection at one point many years ago.
I did. I decided that it was impossible to collect in a truly comprehensive way both Sherlockian material and mystery fiction. In the Sherlockian material, I did keep the canon, the first editions of all of the Sherlock Holmes books, and all of the mysteries, the parodies and pastiches. It was just the Sherlockian criticism and other material that I disposed of.
Hmm. So, Jerry, as long as we still have you here, why Otto? I mean, there's a lot of dealers out there, I would imagine. You could probably tell us a little bit about how many Sherlockian dealers there are, but why Otto for you?
Well, I think basically, I mean, I've known Otto, I think, before there was a Mysterious Bookshop. Mm. I met Otto right around the same time that I met Norman Nolan and Marv Epstein when I was a fledgling who knew not very much about rare books or collecting. And over the years, I have bought just a few books from you, Otto. And we I like to think that we've developed a good friendship over all of these years. And my first stop when I get into New York every year since 1974 whenever the shop opened, has always been Otto's store. I made a beeline there and bought and bought and bought. I think Otto was the natural person to go to. He certainly had the knowledge, the wherewithal, to be able to carry this whole process off as easily and as painlessly as possible, both for me and for him. So I thought that was the natural place to go. There were other people to think about, but I really, after I gave it a lot of thought, I really boiled it down to that Otto was the natural place to go. A lot of the books came from him, and it was kind of coming full circle. to have a lot of it go back there.
And Otto, you must have seen a lot of collections come by your way in your time. You know, people who, like Jerry, made the decision to utilize your services. And when you saw Jerry's collection, or when you reviewed Jerry's collection, did you actually go and visit Jerry in Oregon and see the collection firsthand?
I did. I flew out, spent the weekend, stayed with Jerry at his house, and examined the books. They were in such terrific shape in terms of easy viewability, and Jerry was pretty particular about condition and was very knowledgeable, a very knowledgeable collector, so I didn't have to open every single book to make sure that it was the first edition, that it was in nice condition, and so on. And I wound up finishing in about 5 or 6 hours, what I thought would take the best part of 2 days. So we just went out to a street fair and watched a Yankee game for the rest of the time. Yeah, I saw every book in the collection.
More Yankees.
Now, why did it take you such a quick time when you thought it was going to take longer?
Well, as I said, the books were on shelves. You know, I bought a collection of 27,000 volumes once, and it most
just once
were much at one time. Yeah, it was one collection, and many of the books were in boxes. They were in a dark basement, shelves so close together you couldn't really bend down. You had to sit on the floor to look at the lower shelves. That took a lot of time. But, you know, Jerry, the books were in a comfortable, well-lighted room, right on shelves, and it was simplicity itself. And also books that I was extremely familiar with, books that I had seen in almost every case, not every case, but in almost every case, had seen several times before, and I knew what I was looking at or looking for. Hmm.
So did you find things in Jerry's collection that you added to your own?
I did. There were a couple of very rare early parodies and pastiches of Sherlock Holmes that a couple of which I had never seen, a couple of which I had never heard about before.
Huh.
Jerry had discovered them or just had a greater knowledge in this area than I did. So I brought about 6 books home.
How did Jerry, from your perspective, I think one of the things people would be interested in, I'm certainly interested, how does the world look from your eyes? I mean, is the Margolin collection, you know, sort of loom large like the library at Alexandria, or okay, a good-sized collection, not bad? I mean, what's the scale? What's the frame of reference here?
Well, it was an excellent collection in most ways. I mean, to be fair, I wouldn't rank it as one of the greatest in the world, because it lacked one of the things that a great collection, a great Sherlock Holmes collection, needs to have, which is original material. There were no manuscripts, and the paintings and drawings and other artwork Jerry retained. Jerry kept that.
Mm.
And usually for a collection to be a truly great one, it needs original material, material that nobody else would have. You know, a greater number of signed books, presentation copies, manuscripts, corrected proofs, things of that nature. But that aside, it was really quite a wonderful collection. And when people talk about good books and collecting books, the thing that is most significant after the rarity and desirability is the condition. And it's like real estate, you know, the three most important things, location, location, location. With books, it's condition, condition, condition. Unfortunately, this is something that Jerry learned early on, and the books were really in quite wonderful shape.
Mm. So if the situation came up where someday Jerry was looking to sell his art collection, is that something you would take on, or would you shy away from art?
That's a good question. I don't think I'd be the right person for it. I don't know enough about the art world. I don't think I have collectors who collected in that field. but I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, it's something I would certainly have a conversation with, but I'm not sure that I'd be the best person. I think Jerry could probably do better elsewhere.
Hmm. Otto, you know, when you look at the work of decades, like the collection Jerry amassed, now these are clearly purchases, volumes, hunts that he's been on over a very long period of time. I mean, without getting too commercial about it, how do you go about valuing how do you go about arriving at a fair offer? It's a suitable recompense for the collector, but also gives you a reasonable shot at some reasonable margin, considering everything you're putting into the transaction. It's not clear to me how that works.
Well, you know, it's really easy when you do this for a living. You know, if you're an occasional buyer of a valuable book, you know, you may not be aware of the market very well, but there were very, very few books there that I couldn't put a realistic fair price on instantly, you know, mm-hmm. on the spot, without having to do research, without having to think about it, because I've seen them all before and I deal in them all the time, not all at once the way I did with this collection, but you know, there are very, very few surprises. So when you evaluate as a bookseller buying a collection, when you evaluate the collection, you try to come up with a retail price, and you do that by looking at the best books and putting a real price, a good price, a good solid high price on good books, because good books, by which I mean, well, it's not always true, but good books, I mean expensive books. Mm. Expensive books are easy to sell. Good books, once they get into a higher range, into the thousands of dollars, say, rather than the tens of dollars, are much easier to sell. And so when you price the very good books and you come up with a number for that, the rest you can sort of get a rough idea of what they're worth, and you sort of make a ballpark estimate. When I came up with a real number, I rounded it up. I added several thousand dollars to the value, thinking that there were some books there that I hadn't looked at entirely closely, knowing that they were first edition. Some of them were going to be signed, which makes them, in many cases, more valuable. And so I came up with a good ballpark number. And then you add a percent, then you deduct a percentage for what you hope the profit will be.
Mm. And in the years you've done this, as the market moved steadily upward, does it move in fits and starts? You know, is the $400 1968 Hound of the Baskervilles first edition compounded at an annual growth rate of 10% and 15%? You know, $2,000 in 1991 and $5,000 in 2007. I mean, does it follow certain predictable paths, or is it less?
Predictable is putting it a little too stringently. In 1968, a first edition of The Hound of the Baskervilles wasn't $400; it was more like $50. And today, it's more like $3,000 or $2,000 or $4,000. Again, depending on the condition, maybe even more if it's a really fine copy. Good books have almost, I won't say universally, because there are changing tastes, but good books have almost universally all increased in value. In fact, a friend, another customer of mine who's become a good friend, sent me a report from a financial journal. Now, I'm a bookseller, so I don't get financial journals, and I don't read the Wall Street Journal, because booksellers tend not to be people who go into a business hoping to become fabulously wealthy.
But you do read the Baker Street Journal.
voraciously.
Thank you.
And in that report, in that financial report, there was a listing of investments over the course of the last, I think it was 40 years, it might have been 50, and how they did relative to other forms of investment. And the number one form of investment that it, was books, was rare books. No, I'm sorry, art was number one. Contemporary art, modern art was number one. Books were number two. I think real estate was three. I've forgotten what.
See, there you go, Jerry. You got the top two.
with an annual growth rate, showing percentages and all of that. Now, I have never in my life, for my own collection, bought a book because I thought it was a good investment. It's not what serious collectors do. I mean, once you start paying lots of money for a book, you have to be cognizant of the fact that you are putting a lot of money at stake, and you hope that you will that it will retain its value or maybe even make some. But if that's why you're buying books, it's a risky business because that's, that increase in value is across the board. And if you pick the wrong subject, if you pick a wrong area, why then, you could lose money and, you could point to that and say, wait a minute, this was supposed to guarantee me 18% a year and now I'm losing money. Well, you may have just picked the wrong kind of book. In that survey, by the way, modern literature was the fastest growing. Mystery fiction was the second fastest.
Wow.
From your perspective, not as a bookseller, but as a collector, what would excite you? I mean, you've got this immense collection of first editions of mystery fiction and a fabulous Holmes collection. Is it still possible for you to get excited at finding something that... is the thrill still there for you after everything that you've managed to collect and all the things that have passed through your business?
Oddly enough, yes. A line that I've used before, but it is truly the most fun I can have with my clothes on.
I don't want to know about the other.
Well, but I'm sure that most of the folks listen. I mean, every time I've talked with you over the years, I've always had the same sense. How fabulously fortunate you are, because you've turned a personal passion and a personal enjoyment into a very sound and strong business. So you have, many people dream of being able to devote their time to nothing but their passion, book collecting and homes and so on, and that's what you do all the time.
I have told many people, if anybody who will slow down in the street, I'll tell them I feel like I'm the luckiest man in the world.
Yeah.
Mostly because of my wife, but also because of
that's true. I've met Otto's wife. He does not lie. So you obviously you've got the Mysterious Bookshop, and just in terms of a plug on behalf of Otto and on behalf of Jerry, Otto's Bookshop, the Mysterious Bookshop, is located in the Tribeca neighborhood of New York. Specifically at 58 Warren Street, just on the edge of Tribeca. And every year during the BSI weekend, Otto actually hosts a bit of an open house for Sherlockians, where he will bring out all of the Sherlockian material, which, correct me if I'm wrong, Otto, but that does it normally occupy those shelves, or do you rotate inventory in and out?
It's a bookstore. I better rotate inventory.
Okay. I mean, hey, just making sure. So, see, Otto knows his audience. The Sherlockians descend upon New York in January. He brings out all of this wonderful material and hosts an open house on 11 o'clock on Friday morning. This year it'll be Friday, January 11th, at which point, we just show up and start browsing and sluicing and buying. And naturally, this year, one of the gems of the offering will be items from Jerry's collection. So do Jerry a favor, do Otto a favor, show up to 58 Warren Street on the Mysterious Bookshop and buy some great, great Sherlockian material.
And if you mention the name of the podcast, you get a discount, don't you? Isn't that right?
No. Oh. Well, that's up to Otto. If he wants to put out a special offer, that's great. But I'm not getting any side benefit on this.
I'm a bookseller, not a rug dealer.
Damn it, Jim. So aside from being a bookseller, I know you do a bit of writing, and I know you've done some publishing.
Yeah, that's true. I started a publishing company back in 1975 called the Mysterious Press, which I ran for about 15 years before I sold it to Warner Books. And then I had imprints at a couple of other houses, and I now have a publishing imprint at Harcourt.
Okay.
I publish crime fiction. I try to do restricted to literary crime fiction.
Okay.
And what's the name of the imprint?
Otto Penzler Books.
Wow. What are the chances? So did the publishing come before the bookshop and dealership?
Yeah, Mysterious Press started in 1975. The first book came out in 1976, and I opened the bookshop on Friday the 13th of April, 1979.
Okay.
So yeah, it was a
lucky
little
day.
Yeah, it's been a good day for me.
And because of your activities, not only as a bookseller but as a publisher and an editor and a writer, you have built some relationships with some wonderful writers and authors. I remember reading, I don't quite remember where it was, I was reading something by Elmore Leonard, and I remember he had a character named Otto Penzler. It wasn't a particularly attractive character, but I was thrilled to see you pop up in the middle of the story.
Ripped from the headlines.
Actually, I was in two of his books, and actually, it's not a bad character at all. I really like the character.
It was a Nazi in a prisoner of war camp, wasn't it?
Excuse me.
Oh, excuse me.
I was indeed an SS Sturmbannführer, which is a major.
Yeah.
Equivalent of a major.
Can
I finish?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I was in the Africa Corps with Erwin Rommel, and I was simply a soldier fighting for my country.
What was Erwin like?
Erwin was okay, actually. Brilliant soldier. He was sort of very much like George Patton and Douglas MacArthur, two of my heroes. And I was captured, but I didn't do anything wrong. I wasn't a bad guy.
Yep.
I did escape, even though I was really thrilled to be in this prisoner of war camp in Oklahoma. I mean, nobody was shooting at me at three meals a day, but I escaped. You know, I'm German. I just proved that I could.
Yeah.
That's great.
Those are two books in a row, by the way. The second one was called Up in Honey's Room, which was a nice title.
Hmm.
The first one was serialized in the New York Times, Sunday Times magazine.
So, speaking of newspapers, you do a bit of writing now.
Yeah, I started my career as a sports writer.
Really?
First for the New York Daily News, and then I was director of publicity at ABC Sports.
The thrill of victory and the agony of defeat.
Oh.
Now I write a column for the New York Sun every Wednesday, a crime mystery column called The Crime Scene. And I just wrote column 214.
Wow.
So I know it's more than 4 years.
And is that something that you were looking to do and you solicited them, or did they come to you and say, hey, you know, we have a need for a regular columnist from a literary perspective?
I got a letter in the mail one day from somebody I didn't know, who was the cultural editor of The Sun, saying, would I be interested in writing a crime column? And I hate writing. I would rather do anything than write. It's the hardest work I've ever known. And people keep paying me to do it, and I'm not quite sure why. But it was too good to turn down. And I actually don't hate it as much as I used to. It's a little easier for me now than it used to be.
Well, I'll tell you, as somebody who writes a number of blogs on a regular basis, it can be like a veritable albatross hanging over one's head, or around one's neck, wherever they hang them these days. But at the same time, I've found that when I'm really in a groove and I sit down, it just, you know, the words just flow very naturally, and I enjoy it from time to time. So it's kind of a love-hate thing.
A lot of people like it. You know, I didn't say that writing is a terrible thing. I just said I hate it.
Mm.
It's just too hard. I'm congenitally lazy, and to have to produce a column every single week, you know, you finish one, and the deadline is right there. It's only six days away. It's just awful. But it appears to be a very popular column in the paper, and they seem to like it, and so I'm just going to do it until they fire me.
Well, hopefully that won't be anytime soon. Now, Otto, you are a member of the Baker Street Irregulars.
I am indeed.
When were you brought in? When were you investitured?
I don't remember the exact date. It's about 25 years ago, maybe 30. I can't remember for sure. When you get to be my age, you know, certain things vanish in the mists of memory. And that's one of them. I do remember my investiture, though, however.
Well, what's that?
I'm the king of Bohemia.
Aha.
That's a good investiture.
It's a good investiture. I mean, it sounds good. I mean, the guy was a jerk, but at least it's a nice name, a nice title.
Well, from the king of Bohemia to an SS Sturmfuhrer. Now, this is not such a big leap.
It's a history, you know.
I'm sensing a theme here.
Do you remember your first BSI dinner?
I do indeed. I went with a wonderful man named Chris Steinbrenner.
Oh, yeah. May he rest in peace.
Who co-wrote the Encyclopedia of Mystery and Detection with me, which was published in 1976. And we went, and Julian Wolfe was the commissionaire. And I got to meet a lot of people who have become very, very close friends over the years. The first person I met was Mike Whalen, who now runs the joint, and we've been friends ever since.
That's great. And just incidentally, Otto, you were investitured in 1976.
31 years ago. Good grief.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Nearly 32.
And was it Chris who brought you? Was it Chris who brought you into the BSI?
Well, it was Julian who invited me. But since I didn't know anybody, and I tend to be fairly shy and timid, it was a great relief to me to have Chris with me, who was already a friend, and we went together and sat together and all of that. But no, I had a letter from Julian inviting me to attend.
And did you know about the Baker Street Irregulars? Is this something that was Holmes? Did you encounter Holmes when you were a younger man?
Well, you know, people ask me about how I started with mysteries, collecting mysteries, editing mysteries, publishing them, selling them, etc. And I really wasn't much of a mystery reader when I was young. Although, in the fourth grade, in my library class, I don't even know if they have this in public schools anymore, but kids would go into the library twice a week for a one-hour period, and the librarian would talk about Dewey Decimal Systems and the care of books and how great books were, etc. And then for the second half of the hour, you were allowed to read anything in that room that you wanted to. And I picked up an anthology and saw a story called The Red-Headed League and started reading it, and was so enchanted, and then the bell rang, and I couldn't get to finish it.
No.
And I think that's what I did, as if it were yesterday. And I think the fact that I couldn't finish it is what got me so hooked on Holmes later, after I was out of college and all of that, because otherwise it might have vanished with so many other wonderful stories that I read at that time. But the fact that I had to wait another whole week to get to read to finish the end, it just became emblazoned into my brain.
That's funny because I don't know. I can't remember how many times I've heard it, but the fourth grade typically comes up when we ask people about their first time reading Sherlock Holmes stories.
Interesting.
I don't know why.
Well, it must be the right age. You know,
I guess so.
I guess you're 10 years old, right? So, did I know about the Baker Street Irregulars was your question. I had subscribed to the Baker Street Journal. And I was just riveted by it. And then I especially loved the Baker Street Inventory at the back, which announced new books about Sherlock Holmes. And I wrote to Julian, you know, saying, could I join the Baker Street Irregulars? And he explained to me how it worked. We had a nice correspondence. And I don't know, eventually he just said, why don't you come to the dinner? That was, I guess I'd been going for about 10 years before I was investitured. So.
Wow. Wow.
So was your first dinner at the Regency, or were you, was that the Players or Kavanaugh's back in the 60s?
Boy, I don't remember. I don't remember.
See, he can remember the fourth grade, but...
Well, yeah, I can't remember everything. You know, the mind is, you know, the brain is like an attic, you know?
Yeah, that's
so
true.
Lumber.
Yeah, I wonder who said that. So, Otto, let's say somebody was listening to the show here and they're just starting to get into Holmes and very much interested in mystery and crime fiction, and they wanted some tips on where to go or how to get started. How would you guide them as an expert?
Where to get started, what, as a reader or as a collector?
Either one. Well, let's start as a reader and then, you know, how they might build a collection.
Well, as a reader, I would certainly, as I have on literally thousands of occasions, I would steer them to Holmes right away, because I don't care what age, what gender, what nationality, it just doesn't make any difference. If you don't like Sherlock Holmes, you're never going to read mystery fiction, or you don't deserve to. So I would certainly lead them to Holmes, and then I would recommend some more contemporary people who I'm pretty confident they would like. Both genders would like Michael Connelly. If it were a woman, I would say, you know, read some Agatha Christie. If it were a tough guy, I would say read Red Dragon by Thomas Harris. You know, there are books that I could lead them to and say, start with these, find out which ones you like the most, and then call me again and I'll tell you where to go from there. I'll tell you where to go. With collecting, I would need to know what kind of money they have. You know, if it's a high school kid who wants to start collecting, it's not impossible, but it's a little bit more restrictive. If it were a very wealthy person, that opens up different areas. But I would find out what they like before I would let them start collecting. I would try to talk them out of it. Try to talk them out of collecting certain areas if it wasn't something that they thoroughly enjoyed. You know, if they liked hard-boiled fiction and they wanted to collect Agatha Christie, I would suggest that they start with a few other people, Hammett and Chandler instead. If it was somebody with a very sensitive nature who liked mystery stories, detective stories, but they wanted to get some, you know, really violent noir fiction, I would probably steer them away from that into something with which they'd be a little bit more comfortable.
With all of the people that you've come in contact with, all of the customers and all of the collectors, from your perspective, are there any things that are there things that tie collectors together? Is there sort of a common set of attributes?
You know, that's a really, really good question, and I think it's a long answer, which I won't try to do, but I will say a couple of things that have leaped out at me over time, because I've thought about this. You know, for 29 years, my story is almost as much about collecting as it is about reading, and so naturally I've tried to find that common thread. One is they're probably pretty educated. People need to be, I don't like to use the word just smart, but they need to be educated and thoughtful and have roots. Somebody who's comfortable being encumbered, as it were, with objects in a very stable environment. I think that's key. Another that I don't know why it is, but and you only learn it as you get to know the collector, it's somebody who's always collected. He's always collected something. Might have been stamps or coins as a kid, or anything, baseball memorabilia, could have been anything. But he likes it. It's somebody who likes to collect. It's usually a guy. There are more men who collect mystery fiction in my long experience than women, probably by a multiple of 10 to 1. And I don't know why that is. I've never quite understood why, but it just is from experience.
Great. So people can find you on mysteriousbookshop.com. That's your website. Looks to me like you've got an interesting setup there in terms of clubs. You've got the Crime Collectors Club, the First Mystery Club, the Soft Boiled Club, the Hard Boiled Club, the Over Easy Club, I guess. No, the British
Club.
The British Crime Collectors Club and the Unclassifiable Club.
Right.
What are these?
Well, they're book clubs, as you might expect.
Yeah.
Where we each month make a selection for our customers, and they get automatically in the mail an autographed first edition. The major club, the Crime Collectors Club, tend to be the big names: Michael Connelly, Elmore Leonard, Janet Ivanovich, Sue Grafton, Robert B. Parker, Dick Francis, Dennis Lehane. Those have all been regular members, regular selections of our club. The first mystery is exactly what it sounds like. We do a lot of reading. I have five people who work with me on a full-time basis, and we all read a lot. And every month we pick what we think is going to be an especially terrific first novel. Then we do the same with a private eye book. Hardboiled is not always private eye, but frequently. So we'll take either a noir book or a private eye book for that club. And then, you know, something a little bit softer, Cat Solving the Crimes, or, you know, Hairdresser Mysteries, or whatever, for the Softboiled Club. Although we try to make them as good as possible.
So
the British Club, of course, are imports from England, again, autographed first editions. And the Unclassifiable Club tend to be literary. They're crime-connected, but still literary.
Okay. So what really intrigues me here is your first mystery club, where you're picking authors who have put out their first book, and you're basically a talent scout, as it were.
Right.
Who would you say is the pick that you are the most proud of, who really either rose at the top of the genre or did something remarkable that you could point to, hey, I knew them when?
There are quite a few. Michael Connelly, we picked Black Echo as our first mystery selection. It was the easiest pick of the year because, you know, anybody who read it just knew this guy was going to be terrific. It was a terrific book, and he's gone on to a hugely successful career. We picked Dennis Lehane's A Drink Before the War, Patricia Cornwell, Postmortem. You know, there have been quite a few people along the way.
That's great.
We miss some every now and then, but you know, we have a pretty good record. The staff is pretty bright, and they really know their stuff. They read a lot, and they have good taste.
Well, great. Well, I think we're getting to the end of our time together. Is there anything that you would want to add, Otto, that maybe we've missed or that you'd particularly like to point people towards or anything?
Well, I would say that if a listener or a reader doesn't think he's a mystery fiction fan, you should give it a try. Let somebody who knows what he's doing recommend a good book to you, and you'll find that it's every bit as good as the so-called general or literary fiction that they normally like. And on the second subject of collecting, I would say that you should, if this is something that interests you, you should think about it and pursue it, because it doesn't have to be just a form of entertainment for only the wealthy. You can do it for very little money. I did for many, many years before I had two dimes to rub together. Jerry collected a wonderful collection on a very limited budget for a long time, and many collections, great collections, have been put together by people with very limited budgets who just had a passion for it, and I think it's worth going for.
That's great advice. And, you know, when I'm ready to start collecting, you know, SS officer biographies, I'll know exactly who to turn to. So, well, Otto, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for taking time out of your hectic schedule and your football schedule to be with us.
It's a joy. I love talking about books.
Yeah, yeah. And personally, I will look forward to seeing you again in January. I know I had a great time just being seated next to you at the BSI dinner last year. And
well, of course you did.
Oh, well. Well, yes. Let's see if we can arrange that again.
You have to get out more, Monty. Yes.
All right, Otto. Take care, and thanks very much.
Thank you all. Bye, Bert, Jerry,
bye-bye.
And
bye-bye,
Scott.
Take care, Otto. Well, that was another terrific conversation, and the opportunity to talk with Otto not only about the Margolin collection, but about collectors and about his business and how the world looks from his vantage point it was a real treat.
I agree. To me, for years, and I've been a member of the Irregulars for, let's see, it was the class of 2001, I think, so 7 years now, and having gone to the dinner for years before that, I always thought of Otto as kind of this legendary figure. I mean, he's won an Edgar Award, for people who don't know what the Edgars are, that's the award.
Mystery Writers of America.
Absolutely, and typically every year there will be some sort of Sherlockian who's honored for his or her work. Les Klinger, for example, was awarded most recently. Dan Stasauer has been awarded.
Sure.
So to me, Otto always seemed like this legendary, unapproachable figure. And as I said, I sat next to him at the BSI dinner last year, and we had a great time. We really did. And I feel like I've struck up this friendship with Otto that... As you could hear, Jerry's had a friendship with him over the years because of his collecting, and I haven't been in the position to befriend Otto because of collecting. I mean, I certainly visit his shop, and I will buy things from him from time to time, but it's not like Otto's on my speed dial or anything like that. So having the opportunity to make his acquaintance through this organization, it proves to me why the Sherlockian social network, as Mike said a couple of shows ago, is almost like Rotary. You can call anybody up who's in this with you, and you have this connection, and you can learn some great things from people.
Well, it's true. It's the great leveler, the interest in Sherlock Holmes. Everyone from presidents to postman, I think, as we've unoriginally observed in the past. But Otto mentioned during the course of our conversation a much lamented Sherlockian, Chris Steinbrenner. And Chris, is another example. Did you know Chris?
I did not, but I know you did. I know Charlie Adams did. I know Charlie has some great stories about Chris, and we should get Charlie on the show sometime. But Peter Blau mentioned him.
That's right. And Peter was an old friend of Chris. For those who don't know Chris, and Otto mentioned him as the joint author of the, I think it was the films of Sherlock Holmes. Chris was also involved in the Mystery Writers of America, and I think he was president for at least 1 year. And I know he had won an Edgar because I remember it was in his office. Chris was the group film director for WOR when the General Tire Company, which owned WOR, had a chain of television stations, and every year on Thanksgiving he always programmed King Kong followed by Son of Kong. He was a wonderful guy, but Chris's collecting passion was in films and in the pre-VHS, pre-Betamax, pre-tape days. Chris had a home and a garage full of cans of 16mm film, and his objective in life, as he would frequently say, was to see every mystery film ever made, if not own it. I think he would have been perfectly happy to own it, but at minimum he wanted to see every one of them. And these were the days when, for the Science Society meetings, Chris would always bring up a projector and a speaker and a screen and cans of film, and we would screen films. But he was a wonderful, enthusiastic, delightful, lovely, and much missed.
I know. I really wish I had gotten a chance to know him and experience some of his offerings there. I was lucky enough, having been born and raised in Connecticut, to partake in the Men on the Tour, which had as part of its membership a gentleman by the name of Cortland Hull.
Oh, sure. And oh, yeah. I remember Cortland. He's still around.
He is. And Cortland's great uncle, of course, was Henry Hull from The Werewolf, and Josephine Hull from Arsenic and Old Lace. So I exactly came from a theatrical background, and he might actually be somebody to have on the show one time, too, because he had connections with Vincent Price and a number of characters, and he always would show the old films. You know, he would be very specific. You know, it's not videos. He would bring his films and his projector and show clips.
That's right. And, now, didn't you do a meeting? Didn't we have a meeting up
in
Boston?
We did. It was 1997, 98 or so at the Algonquin Club in Boston, where we did a tribute to the life of Basil Rathbone.
Basil Rathbone, right. And Cortland brought a Rathbone life mask,
right.
I remember. And he laboriously put together, he'd cut the, I mean, he brought a reel.
Right,
I remember
absolutely. The lights were dimmed, and he...
He edited together on a 16-millimeter reel these various clips
right.
of Rathbone.
And I think, as part of it, just for fun, he brought Deduce, You Say, the old Daffy Duck and Porky Pig cartoon.
Yes, I remember
that. The Shropshire Slasher.
Slasher. Yeah, but now, 10 years later, we've got that on DVD.
Know.
You know, I've got that downstairs on my
right.
Warner Brothers Looney Tunes DVD
set. Yeah, but there really is something about watching those... you know, from the reels. So that, rest assured, we can do a number of shows in the future about film, and we can have any number of experts join us there. So, and again, it'll be interesting. As we just talked about you know, art with Jerry, and Peter Blau had chided me at a certain point saying, well, it'll be interesting to see if you can do a podcast, an audio podcast about art.
Well, you know, when Edgar Bergen and Charlie when Bergen wanted to go on the radio, the thing that the producers couldn't quite understand was how he was going to make ventriloquism work on the radio. Well, it took about 5 minutes and managed to make it work pretty successfully.
And from what I understand, he still didn't move his lips even on the radio. So a true
professional. Well, unfortunately, I wish that was true, but actually, I think one of the things that that sadly deteriorated Bergen's lip control was the years on radio when he didn't really have to worry about it.
Yeah. Well, so we'll see how we can work that out. So, in the meantime, I think this is where we get to the editor's gas lamp.
Yeah. Well, for this editor's gas lamp, I've selected one of Edgar's writings from 1947. It's the old series, volume 2, number 3. And as we were ending the discussion with Otto, he pointed out what young people today, or younger people today, if you're in high school and you are interested in collecting and reading mystery fiction, if you're interested in collecting Sherlockiana, that there are things to do. And this focus on the next generation, on newcomers to the Sherlockian world, was the focus of this particular editor's gas lamp, which Edgar entitled The Fortunate Ones. And it's particularly appropriate considering that in a couple of weeks we're going to have the next Baker Street Irregulars meeting in January. So Edgar writes, "It was a heartening experience at the meeting of the Baker Street Irregulars last January to look around the room and take count of the many young faces that brightened an otherwise august and rather doddering assemblage. The legend has persisted too long, certainly, that only those who sowed their oats by gaslight are eligible for this inner circle, or that a purely personal nostalgia is essential to affection for the man who stands as symbol of the old remembered times. Sherlock Holmes has more than this to commend him to the world's esteem, and the rising generation knows it. Some of the men in their 30s and their 20s who sat with the irregulars that night were the sons, the scions, if you will, of the founding gaffers whose roots lie deep in the beckoning past. A few of them, perhaps, were there from filial piety, or as a mere gesture of imitation. But there were many more who came with or without parental tutorship and incitement, for the simple and satisfying reason that they had found something they liked, and that they liked what they'd found. Such neophytes, whether within the body of the irregulars themselves or as a part of the burgeoning societies out around the land, are the fortunate ones among us. For theirs is a wholly objective devotion, unbolstered by the treacherous props of memory. But happier and more fortunate still, if we stop to consider, are those virginal souls, young and old alike, who have never read the tales of Sherlock Holmes at all. Here is the optimum of all potential. For them, the world has not begun, and they have yet to live. Think what it is they have before them. We who have wisdom in the lore would not give up one whit of what we have acquired. But for these others, the joy that we have known is promised in the very fact of acquisition. It is a joy that we would know anew if only ignorance could be recaptured and innocence restored. What ransom would we pay if we could wonder once again at the meaning of the task poor Jabez Wilson had been called upon to do? If we could speculate upon the sinister and mysterious significance of the dancing men, and how we would delight to find ourselves bewildered by the tiny footprints in the attic of the house where Bartholomew Sholto had died in agony, or by the cryptic references to the gypsy band that roamed the neighborhood of Stoke Moran. These are the voyages of great discovery that we can never take again. Footprints? Footprints. A man or a woman's? Oh, we know the epic answer, but how we wish that we did not.
That's great. You know, I mean, yes, we do know the answer to that exchange, but still, every time I hear it or every time I read it, I still get a chill up my spine.
Mm.
It's amazing the effect that those words have. Mm. Two thoughts come to mind after hearing you read that. One is, even though I read probably the core of the canon, and when I say core, I mean A Study in Scarlet, A Sign of Four, The Adventures, The Memoirs, The Return, and Hound. When I was first discovering Sherlock Holmes, when I was in high school. But it wasn't until I went away to college that I discovered the rest of the canon. Simply because the edition that I had was just kind of a best of compendium. It was not the complete canon. I still remember the feeling I had discovering some of those later stories and just how, I don't know, how wistful I was almost to finally read the 60th story and to know there were no more. But to have that sense of wonderment and almost, you know, I almost remember the exact time and place where I was when I was reading those stories and can picture the emotion in my mind, but I can't recapture it if I just sit down to read those stories. Mm. It's a wonderful, wonderful memory.
Do you go back and reread the canon every so often?
Well, sure. Whenever I can. It's not as often as it used to be, but you know, when I'm going to a meeting and a story is, you know, the theme of the evening, I try to refamiliarize myself with it at that point. But you know, there are times I'll go back and I'll read collections and, you know, even go back to those core stories and reread them. And every mm-hmm. time I do, I seem to pick up something that I missed before.
Mm.
Do you?
Well,
there's so much to read, you know.
Yeah, there is.
And Sherlockian and non-Sherlockian alike. I mean,
yeah, I've got stacks and stacks of books that I haven't read yet, but yeah, I do, you know, typically I'll reread a story these days when I'm going to a meeting of one of the Sherlockian societies, and you know, I'll reread the story for the meeting, you know, so that if there's although I typically don't bother to take the quizzes, but it's a good excuse to reread it. You know, for example, we just did for the Cornish Horrors, we just did a study in Scarlet because our focus for the meeting was the 100th anniversary of the publication. So I reread the study in Scarlet. But like you, I always find something new that I didn't notice before. But you know, that's one of the benefits of having it's one of the benefits of having a not terrific memory, and it's one of the benefits of aging, in that you know, you can rediscover things you know, a couple of years pass and you read it all over again.
Yeah. Well, actually we have a listener comment to get to now. We were lucky enough to have gotten some feedback after the show, the first show that we did with Mike Whalen a few weeks ago. And this comment actually comes to us from Mark Whalen, who is Mike's oldest son. Ooh. And I, you know, it's funny that this should come in now, because it's completely apropos of what you just read in The Gas Lamp, of you know, the next generation being there, and being there sometimes out of filial piety.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually just on the phone with Mike today and let him know that his son Mark wrote to us. And he said, you know, I'm really not a fan of nepotism, of bringing, you know, my own kids in. But he said, Mark has expressed some interest for some time, not necessarily because he's interested in Sherlock Holmes, but because he wants to see this other part of my life that he really hasn't taken part in, and wants to see it just because he's interested in me as his dad. So I thought that was interesting. So here's what Mark had to say. The subject line of the email is, "Hello from Denver. Gentlemen, I am Mike's oldest son, Mark, and I just wanted to compliment you both on the comprehensive interview with my father. It was nice to hear some of the ideas and stories that Dad has about the BSI. Many of these stories are things he's never told me, so it's good to hear his unique perspective on both the past and the future of this fine organization. I'm biased, but I think Dad is the perfect person to be running the BSI. He once told me that his dream was to be the CEO of a Fortune 500 company. He realized that dream through his involvement with a few companies, but I really believe that he has fulfilled his dream through his love of all things Sherlock. Thanks again, Mark Whalen."
You know, it's a great comment. That's one of the side benefits of this series of podcasts, is you get to talk in depth with people that you've known for a long while, but you may not have had a chance really to sit and talk about their own experiences in an extended way. And it's great to, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, it's not like any of this stuff is etched in stone. But the fact that, you know, Mike Whalen's thoughts and experiences are a matter of public record in perpetuity is really terrific.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we go into 2008, I think we have a whole stable of interviews and subjects that we will be lining up. But that's not to say that we're not looking for input. And to your point, Bert, the comments are great to hear, particularly because we know whether we're hitting the right note or not, and we're getting some additional unique perspective from folks. And this is a conversational medium, so please do take advantage of that. Again, it's 774-221-7323, 774-221-READ. Email is comment@ihearofsherlock.com, or certainly on the website at www.ihearofsherlock.com. But please take the opportunity to give us suggestions. If you know of somebody that we should be interviewing, or an event that may be worthy of note, please drop us a line and let us know, because even though we call the show I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, we can't necessarily be everywhere. So please absolutely drop us a line and help us form the future of this show, because this is your show just as much as it is ours.
Yeah, we really do appreciate your suggestions and direction, and we might not be able to get to it right away, but rest assured, we will.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that brings us to the end of a nice two-part series here once again. And until next time, I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Bert Wolder, and the game's afoot.